set things down for a second.
Okay.
I still do electrical work.
Oh, yeah. What do they call it?
Jacob's ladder.
Jacob's ladder, yeah.
It's something that comes out of the Bible, but I don't know where. the term Jacob's ladder is in there someplace.
Wow.
Everybody ought to have one of those.
Yeah, I think so. You build that one yourself?
Oh, this is just odd man. I have all kinds of stuff like that.
That's great.
That was Dick Blends showing me his Jacob's ladder, which is set up in his living room. You can see it right when you walk into his house. As an electronics specialist, he's got a lot of this stuff lying around. This was right after the interview was over, and I wish I could have just hung around and saw the cave archives in his basement and who knows what else. I mean, his house looks like it's been lived in by the same person for 50 years, and so there's all kinds of fascinating stuff laying around. But I had to leave and get back to work that afternoon. He's a great guy, and I was lucky to spend so much time with him back in May to get this interview. We'll get to part two in just a few minutes. If you're here, you know this is the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser. I'm the chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto of the National Speleological Society. If you're new to the podcast, I'd recommend you start with the previous episode, part one of my conversation with Dick Blends. If you're new to caving, welcome. If you haven't yet joined a grotto, your local chapter of the National Speleological Society, I would recommend you find one at the NSS website, caves.org. Caving is a great way to explore places very few people get to see. Indeed, places that very few people are willing to go through the trouble of seeing. That said, caving can be dangerous if you're ill-equipped or inexperienced, so make some friends at your local grotto and do it the right way. And of course, never cave alone. Always go in groups of three or more and bring three sources of light, reliable sources. A quick technical note, if you're an Android user, this podcast is now available on Google Music, so you don't have to go to the Podomatic site to hear it anymore. This episode marks 1 year since I started the podcast. You know, I wasn't sure how much mileage I would get out of a podcast about caving. As it is, there are so few cavers, as I'm finding out, even fewer of them want to talk about caving and have it go on the internet. Cavers are funny sometimes. You know, it's like they want to keep this thing a secret, which I completely understand. We certainly don't want everyone doing this. But in doing this show, I've heard from so many cavers who love listening and appreciate what I'm doing. And to you, I say, thank you. It's a lot of extra work to put this thing out every month. And, that said, I could use some help finding guests. If you'd be willing to come on the show, yes, you, let me know. If you know someone who'd be willing to come on the show, let me know. You don't have to travel all the way to Indianapolis. We could do it over Skype or FaceTime, whatever you want. And as I said in the last episode, I'm a new dad now, so my time is pretty limited. If you want to come on, come to me. I'd appreciate it. Of course, the Caving Podcast is sponsored by Swago, makers of some of the best cave packs out there. Except now, if you want one, you got to find a used one. They ran into supply problems a while back and haven't been able to get new packs back on the market. But Scott's testing out new materials to get the packs out again as soon as he can. Keep listening for updates. Check the Swago Gear Facebook page. Meanwhile, you can still get chicken loops, sight lights, sight light shields, rope traps, stickers, and other stuff at his website, swagogear.com. If you need any of that stuff, pick it up. Help him put a little cash toward developing some new packs so we can get those Swagos back. Again, swagogear.com, S-W-A-Y-G-O, gear.com. Dick Blends, part two, coming up in just a bit. But reminder, first, my grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto, is putting on Indiana Cave Capers the first weekend in August, the 4th through the 6th at the Harrison County Fairgrounds, which is right across the creek from historic downtown Corydon, Indiana's first state capital. This is going to make it a great caving event to bring family or non-caving friends along to, because there's great stuff to do in Corydon. Restaurants, shops, plenty of show caves around, Indiana Caverns, Marengo Cave, Squire Boone. So make plans. Join us in Indiana August 4th through the 6th for Indiana Cave Capers. We got great caves here in the Hoosier State, and we'll have a bunch of great lead trips through Indiana's longest cave, Binkley, in addition to all the other great caves in the area. Plus a jam session Friday night at the campground led by Ron Adams, who was my first ever guest on the podcast. We got a great program planned for Saturday night. Door prizes, a barbecue banquet. There's a pool just up the hill that'll be open. Come on out. Register online at CIGCaves.com, my grotto's website, CIGCaves.com. And another quick note about my grotto. Our library is one of the largest collections of cave information in the country, and we just moved it into temporary storage. Our quartermaster and librarian, Bob Van Dievender, has been a faithful steward of this library for years and years, but he suffered a stroke last year, and we had to move it out of his house. We worked out a deal with my wife's employer, Sun King Brewing. They're a craft brewery here in Indianapolis. And they were gracious enough to supply us with an office that they weren't using. And we packed that thing to the brim this past Tuesday with all the boxes and filing cabinets. So if you're ever in Indy, stop by the brewery and have a pint. We owe them a lot for helping us out. Dick Blends. What more can I say about the guy? He bought Buckner Cave back in the early 60s and made it the Spelio spot here in Indiana. Everyone's been to Buckner for better or for worse, and now the NSS owns the property. And just a quick note here before I hit play. Part one of this interview was the most listened to episode of the Caving Podcast yet. So a big welcome to all the new listeners. Now, here's part two. Enjoy.
Part of the cave is right behind the house here.
Yeah.
30 feet down.
Volcano room, right?
The volcano room is between the house next door and the one next door to that. It's between those two.
Hmm.
And it's down there about 130 feet. In fact, the house two doors over had changed hands, and they wanted to drive a well.
Ah.
There is no water. There was no city water out here then. And so they didn't consult with us. They just went ahead and drove a well out behind the house. And they hit empty space, and they hit something like 16 feet of empty space, and they had to put in casing and all that stuff. If we had known where they were going to drill, and we had accurate maps by that time, we could have pushed their well 20 feet over, and they would have been in rock all the way home. But they didn't. So you can go into Buckner Cave, into the volcano room. And back there in the corner, you'll see the well pipe.
I've seen it.
Yeah.
I've seen it back there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we could have saved them a lot of time and trouble.
Yeah. it didn't really end up, did it end up working as a well for them?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
it did?
Yeah,
okay.
It still is. And I don't know if they still use it because they brought water out here finally, but not here. I'm not on the water line. The water line ends 20 feet the other side of my boundary.
Oh, of course.
Wouldn't bring it up. So I think they went off to the water supply, but I'm still on a well.
Mm. You dug a pit into the volcano room.
Oh.
And you were thinking about building down in there.
I'm one of the designers, the original designers, of the radio cave mapping system.
I wondered about that.
The magnetic system.
Yeah.
In 1960, I was at the University of Chicago. There was an industrial magazine in this country for the electronics industry.
Mm.
And we would get a copy of it every month. And actually what it was new ideas and new things coming out. And advertising jobs and all this stuff. And we opened it up that day, and it had an article, Mapping Caves Magnetically.
I'm interested.
Well, this was interesting.
Yeah.
And, of course, I understood what they were trying to do as soon as they described it, you know. I said, well, yeah, I guess you can do it that way. So I thought, well, why don't I make one of these damn things? So I went to my shop at Chicago, and I had a good electronic shop there, and I sat down, and I built the first one.
Ah.
And years later, I learned that the guy, some guy named Sheldahl or something, I forget, was an electronics person at Naval Avionics in Indianapolis. And why he wrote this article, I don't know.
Mm.
But he wrote it and it got into electronics. And later on, I learned that he had never been in a cave. He was not a caver. But anyway,
but
he wrote
this article.
Yeah, he wrote this thing. Well, I built the thing and used some of his technology, but transistors had shown up by that time, and his stuff was in vacuum tubes.
Mm.
So I modified things and so on, and finally came up with the unit, and we were started bringing it down here and doing survey with it and so on. And I had that thing. In fact, the transmitting antenna is downstairs here in the basement, the first one. And I finally came down here, and we were doing surveys with it. And one day, the state of Indiana decided to buy Wyandotte.
Mm, right.
Make a state recreational area out of that thing. Wyandotte is a very famous cave.
Sure.
Been around for a long time. They decided that they wanted to put electric lights in the big cave.
Mm.
Across the entrance from Wyandotte is Little Wyandotte, and that was all commercialized. Big Wyandotte was commercialized, but when you went in, you carried a lantern, and they wanted to modernize it. So they wanted to put electric lighting into Big Wyandotte. So they went to Naval Avionics, and they said, we'd like to have a survey made of the cave to find out where to put power lines in.
Mm-hmm.
And they described the problem. And Avionics said, no way. I think they quoted a price which was outrageous, and the state decided against that. And so the state then went to Purdue. Purdue has a survey system, you know, teaches geology and so on and so forth.
Sure.
Went to Purdue and they described what they wanted. Went to their civil engineering department. Said, we would like to have two holes driven from the surface into two rooms about a mile apart in the cave. And we'd like to get a survey made from those rooms out to the surface and back over the top to find out where to put a drill. And Purdue took one look at that job, and they said, impossible. They said, we'd have to use optical survey going over hills and dales and around the inside the cave.
Yeah.
For a mile or two back.
Well, yeah.
And then come out and then do it on the surface and get it to come out exactly.
Yeah.
They said, we don't think it's practical. So now the state was, what are we going to do? Well, there was a man here in Bloomington.
Ah, yes. Dick Powell.
Dick Powell. Richard L. Powell was working for Indiana University as a coal geologist, but he was highly interested in caves.
Yeah.
And he wrote that book finally in 1961. Well, Powell was here, and he had surveyed Wyandotte Cave
mm-hmm.
with a plane table system. A plane table is a flat table sitting on tripod with telescope on it and paper, and actually you would draw the map as you went through the cave. And when you came out, you had a map of the cave.
Wow.
A line map of the cave.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful technique, but you got to have some space to work with.
Sure.
Well, Wyandotte, plenty big.
Yeah.
So he had done a survey. He knew very accurately what that cave looked like, its layout. So the state knew about that. So the state came to him, and they said, we'd like you to show us where to put the two holes to bring down power cable. And Dick says, I can't do that. He says, I know very precisely to the inch what this cave looks like, but I don't know where it is. It's somewhere in that hill, but I don't know accurately where it is.
Yeah.
And then he said, but I do know a person who can find out. And he gave him my name.
Ah, of course.
So I actually signed a contract with the state of Indiana, and Dick Powell and the manager of Wyandotte went into the cave with my radio transmitting system, magnetic system.
Yeah.
And I picked a guy named Larry Townsend, who was working at IU in the cyclotron, and he was a caver, and I says, we got a job to do.
Yeah.
So we were on the surface, and we finally found the spot. And it was about 360 feet down, and we just barely made it.
Mm-hmm.
But we did find the spot, and we put a big mark on the ground and put an X and drill here. And then at the same time, we went a mile further and found a second spot. And that took quite a bit of time that day to do all of that.
I bet.
And so then the state went out and they hired somebody to come and drill holes. And we told them, set your drill up and make sure that it's absolutely level, that it's absolutely square with the ground, and drill exactly where we tell them. Okay. They thought this was kind of strange, but oh, well. They went ahead and they drilled on the first one, and they broke into cave. We had had a mark on the ceiling that our transmitter had been directly underneath,
mm-hmm.
as to where they wanted to come through. It was a small room back there someplace. Figured that was a good place to bring the power box. We got in there. They finally went in to see where the drill had come in, and they couldn't find it. They had actually they knocked the mark out of the ceiling.
It was that close.
And later on, the driller, he said he was astonished. He says, I can drill 6 feet in any direction per 100 easily.
Mm-hmm.
He says, it's just the nature of the thing.
Sure, sure. Makes sense.
And he says, we knocked out the thing in the ceiling. They went to the second hole, and they missed the mark by about 6 or 8 feet, but it was still in the room. So that was fine. No problem.
Yeah, yeah.
About a month later, I got a letter from Purdue University.
Who said it was impossible.
And essentially he said, how did you do that?
I'm not telling.
That made me feel real good.
I bet it did.
Said, how did you do that? I said, well, we didn't do it with optical instruments, believe me. We did it with electronic. That didn't make them very excited.
No.
But I think they paid us $1,200 for that job. And I paid everybody off. And they brought out Highline, this 7200 volt line out to the two holes, put in transformers and ran entrance cables down into the cave, and they put lights in all over the place. And they didn't do a very good job, but it's illuminated.
Sure.
So that was my experience with the state of Indiana.
Well, so did you then use that to figure out where to dig to get into the volcano room?
Oh, down here?
Yeah.
We had used the cave mapper to find out exactly where Buckner Cave was.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of side passages and things in it. So we decided to find out where the little volcano was exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had drawn a map. The map was quite accurate, and they had put it down on the quadrangle sheet. We had a blown-up quadrangle sheet, and we accurately put it down on there. And a potential entrance was way out on the east side, just over Buddy Rogers' land.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big sinkhole over there. And so they had put the map down, and we had located that sinkhole accurately over there, and that was on the maps. So they laid the map of the cave on it and photographed it and all. and we thought we knew where the volcano room was.
Sure. Little volcano.
And the little volcano and all that. So we put a transmitter at the little volcano.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, it was just a lot of mud coming in through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out with the receiver to find out where it was. The map showed that where we were going to drill was across the road and about 200 or 300 feet off that way.
Yeah.
So I went over there and waiting for the transmitter to come on. And all of a sudden it came on, but it was way out of line. I mean, what the heck? So I did the things to try to find out where zero was.
Mm-hmm.
And I went working around, and suddenly I was standing where the hole is right now. I said, I'll be damned. We made a mistake on the map.
Yeah.
So later on, we took the map and anchored it at the hole at the east end and just physically rotated the whole map, and that thing moved right into position. And so we knew precisely where the entrance was.
Sure.
So we decided, well, let's make an entrance.
Yeah.
So we started digging, and we finally broke into it 35 feet deep, and it came down into the volcano room.
Perfect.
And so we opened up the pit. We did a lot of digging and put a ladder in, and we had an entrance to the cave. And then I thought, you know, it would be neat to have a house down here. It enters into the volcano passage, and it's big, and it's high, and it's dry.
Yeah.
And it's got a nice flat ceiling, and there's plenty of room to put a house in here.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'd like to try to do that. So that was the idea at that time. About that time, my father, he got interested in the place. He actually climbed down the ladder. He was getting pretty old by that time. He was getting to climb down the ladder. Wow, you got quite a place down here. Came back up. And he suddenly said, I'd like to build my last house for you here on this property. And he says, but I do not want to put it underground.
Okay. Well.
Well, I was getting contractors' prices and a lot of help. And so I thought, well, okay. So we built here. We let that go down there.
Yeah.
And finally it collapsed in.
Yeah.
And because we didn't have it secured. But I had plans for putting an electric lift and all the whole thing in there.
Sure.
But it never worked out.
Do you ever think about the way you would have done it if you had decided?
Oh, yes.
So how would you
have
done
it? We
had
full plans about the house and how to build it. One of the big advantages was that it's 54 degrees down there.
Sure. Natural insulation.
You could put a heat exchanger in there and pump the cave and heat the house.
Yeah.
And it would be real cheap because when you transfer heat, that's cheaper than manufacturing it out of electricity or something. Mm-hmm. Much cheaper. And it turned out the whole thing planned out to be quite practical.
Yeah.
I still think it would be practical to live down there. And but you were underground, and actually we would have had a way of exhausting house air and so on and so forth. But the cost of doing it was really minimal.
Yeah.
And the cost of maintaining it would have been really minimal. In fact, I even went and somebody interviewed me on television in Indianapolis about this thing.
At the time?
And so I got on national TV about it, but Dad decided against it. So that was the end of that.
Oh, man. So would it have been, I'm sorry, I keep asking about it. It's just something that, that really interests me. So would you have just kind of built a small structure in there? Would you have incorporated the rock wall? Would you have just put up walls in certain areas? And
oh, no. I would probably have used one wall of that room as a wall in the house.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of it would be lightweight construction,
mm-hmm.
Well insulated, so that your heating would be very effective.
Sure.
And
would
I don't know. It was just a neat idea.
I think. Yeah.
And but we just didn't do it.
Yeah. Would you have closed off the volcano, the big volcano, so that no one could come into the volcano passage?
Oh, No.
Leave it
that
open?
That would have been all open.
Yeah.
That would have been an exit from the house if you ever had to have it.
Of course.
And, no, it's at the end of the long, long passage, you know, the volcano room itself, the volcano passage itself. It's still a very interesting area of the cave.
Oh, yeah. I love it back
there. It's an upper passage. It's an upper cave.
Yeah.
That collapsed into the lower cave.
Long
at
trunk
the volcano
passage.
Room.
Yeah.
So it is dry, and it is a very nice area.
Mm-hmm.
Plans don't always work out.
Yeah. So when did the abuse of the cave really start to kind of get out of hand?
What?
Too much spray paint, too much vandalism. When did that kind of really start to get out of hand?
We started to worry about it pretty early, but how are you going to prevent it?
Yeah.
And finally, it became critical when we're going to say, well, we're going to give this to the NSS.
Mm-hmm.
We ought to give them something that's halfway decent. And so we made some changes.
Mm-hmm.
People would try to clean the cave a little bit, but it was a big job. And we were telling people, you know, you bring out your carbide and so on and so forth. But in those days, even we would go in with carbide and dump it.
Yeah.
But cover it up with soil and dump it. But and then we finally was requiring people to bring carbide out, you know, and it was interesting. We had next to the parking lot down here, we had we drilled a hole in the ground with a post hole digger, and everybody would dump their carbide in that hole, and then when it got filled, we covered it over the soil and drill a second one, and all of a sudden we discovered the grass on top of that hole is absolutely gorgeous. It likes it.
Really?
And it turns out that carbide is a good fertilizer.
Oh, my goodness.
So then we said, well, what we'll do is have people spread it thinly along the road.
Okay.
And then the water will wash it off into the sides and fine. It does no harm whatsoever.
Huh.
And concentrated is a poison, but so is a lot of things.
Yeah.
Concentrated oxygen is a poison if you mm-hmm. get enough of it. And so that was our policy, that people would drop their carbide along the road. And then finally modern lighting began to show up, and carbide was no longer the way to go. But I did a lot of caving with carbide.
Yeah.
And you carried a bottle of water and a bottle of carbide. And
you got light.
And this was all done in little baby bottles that kids used to drink out of.
Yeah.
And you carry a bottle of hard candy.
Yeah.
And that was caving in those days.
That was caving. Can I ask you about Doug Love and his book? And you're putting your head down and laughing. So his book kind of created some problems around here.
He created a lot of problems. In fact, I think it was the cause of three deaths.
Yeah.
Almost positive.
Yeah. And was that the salamander incident?
Yeah. Salamander. When the three guys, when the three people died in Salamander.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of other vandalism, of course, too.
I had to go in there and get their bodies out.
Oh, you were there.
And, Doug Love suddenly showed up. I forget all the details.
He wrote the Spelunker's Guide to the Garrison Chapel Valley. Yeah.
He wrote books.
Yeah.
And
published them and
put
them in.
He gave exact locations exactly. of everything.
You could buy the book anywhere almost.
Yeah. And the book was in every store in town and all of that stuff. And we considered it dangerous as hell.
Yeah.
Well, the three kids that had drowned in Salamander had read that book.
Yeah.
And had been attracted to Salamander. And they just came in at exactly the wrong moment.
Yeah.
And they drowned.
Yeah.
And finally, Love went off. I forget all the details. We've tried to forget him.
Sure.
He went to the East Coast and he got a job doing something out there. And finally, he has disappeared. But no, we were very unhappy with Love.
Do you think it was his? You think it was his fault for a lot of the vandalism in Buckner Cave too?
Very likely.
Yeah.
In the general area, because we didn't. We were getting to the point of not publishing exact locations.
Yeah.
Up to a certain time, that was normal. Every time you published something about Buckner Cave, you had its exact locations in quarter form.
Yeah.
Quarter.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's longitude and latitude because we have satellite now. And a lot of people didn't know how to handle quarter system.
Yeah.
Very luckily, it says, for instance, the northwest quarter of the southwest quarter. And it's just written like that, northwest, southwest, southeast, section such and such, township and range.
Sure.
Okay. A lot of people, huge numbers of people, didn't know how to handle that, because between the two words, northeast, northwest, are two words that do not appear of the.
Of the.
So that means when you read this direction, you read it backwards.
Okay.
The last one is the first one.
Ah.
So a lot of people went out looking for Cave.
didn't find him.
didn't understand what was going on.
Hmm.
But a lot of people did understand it, and we worried about it because, for instance, out here on Garrison Chapel Road, there is a cave back, it's probably a mile and a quarter from here. There's a cave back, sits off the road quite a ways. It was just a hole in the ground, and it had clear, clean rock in it. Obviously got wet occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
We got in there and we surveyed it, and it broke out into a tall crevice. What was remarkable, at the top of the crevice were logs that had floated in there, got to the top of the crevice, got stuck.
Yeah.
Dangerous as heck.
Yeah.
Absolutely deadly cave.
Yeah.
We calculated that an inch of rain would flood that thing to the top.
Wow.
And so we picked some day in January when it had been freezing. You know, the ground was absolutely solid.
Yeah.
And went in and surveyed the place when the water was down. And but it was things like that. It was on that book of his.
Yeah. So
and,
it was...
And, that's all we would have needed is somebody get in there, you know. And there are a lot of those. We always tell people caves are made by, nature makes them by running water.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, she comes back to check her work, and you had better not be in there when that occurs.
Yeah.
Buckner Cave being somewhat of
an exception.
Example of it.
Yeah.
Of it doesn't flood, but that's rare.
Yeah.
And so you should always expect a cave to be a flutter and to have problems like that. But Doug Love did us no favors.
No.
And we were finally to get rid of him because he did cause a lot of trouble.
There were a number of rescues in Buckner Cave. And
dozens of them.
Yeah. And... When I imagine being the owner of the property, you worried a lot whenever there was a rescue?
Generally, people would go down and not have sufficient light.
Mm-hmm.
Light to a caver is the same as a parachute to a diver.
Sure.
You'd better have it, and it had better work.
Yeah.
We had numerous rescues of people who would go in and get confused and run out of light, and we'd go in and find them down there. Okay, fine. We had one major rescue. You've probably read about it.
The volcano room?
I was sitting in this house. In fact, I was asleep. Telephone rings. I answered it, and it was the state police.
Mm.
This was 6 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, boy.
On a Sunday. And they said, "We think you have a problem in Buckner Cave. Somebody has come out and has said there's somebody injured in the cave." I says, "Thank you for calling. We'll look into it right away." The state police, over the years, have learned that they don't want no part of this. we convinced them of that when the three kids drowned in Show Farm Cave. The two kids drowned in Show Farm.
Mm.
They went down there to do a rescue and ended up, we did the rescue, and it wasn't, we did the body recovering.
Yeah.
But the authorities decided they were not positioned to take care of cave rescue, that the cavers were there. And this is an unusual thing in the country. And so anytime there's a rescue call comes in, they call us immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll help. You know, they come out, they do all kinds of things. But to do the actual rescue, no way. They didn't let us do it.
Not cavers.
And I was in the house, and I get the call from state police. So I said, okay, I'll look into it. So I gets up, and I walked back to the barn, which was there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a car parked. It was still kind of dark. And there was a car parked there, and I went up, and I opened. There was a couple of people in it. I said, "What's wrong?" They said, "We just got out of the cave, and there is a man lying at the bottom of the volcano room, obviously injured.
Mm-hmm.
We've left one of our people down there with him, but we're going to have a rescue."
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they told me about that. All right. So I walked back up to the house, and I get on the phone. Well, we have a rescue list, and so I start down the list. Don Paquette was the major rescue person. So I calls Don. I says, "We got a problem." Okay. So he said, "I'll be out." So he came down. Well, I was in the house calling people, and Don comes sailing past the house, and he goes back to the barn, and these people told him the same story, only they added to it. And they said, "The guy who's down there, his buddies are up here in a car on the other side of the barn." They didn't tell me that. His buddies had gotten out of the cave, and they were in the car.
What were they doing in the car?
Well, it turned out that these three guys came to Buckner Cave for the express purpose of going to the volcano room and getting drunk.
Ah, there was a lot of that.
And they took the whiskey in to do so.
Yeah.
Foolishness, I can't understand it. This kid that was in the cave was not a kid. He's a 30-year-old man with a family at home in Indianapolis.
Mm.
And he's down here. The people that were in the car said, "We found him about 3 o'clock this morning," and they came out of the cave, and instead of stopping at the house here, they went around looking for some place to call sheriff, and they got down here to a gas station out here on the highway, and they called the sheriff, and he called me. So, meanwhile, knowing that we were going to have a problem, the rescue started. Knowing that we were going to have a problem, I thought we better call a physician. So we got a hold of Indianapolis.
Methodist Hospital?
At Methodist Hospital.
Yeah.
And I says, we've got a rescue. You better come a running. It looks like a bad one.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll be down. So he gets in his car and he starts for Bloomington. And meanwhile, our people decided we may have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into the Buckner entrance room, on the left side where the crawlway, well, that used to be have a big pile of rocks, big rocks around it. And you almost had to, we knew that we had actually discussed this earlier, that given the need for a straight stretcher, we would have had a hell of a time getting that stretcher up those rocks and into the main entrance room.
Yeah.
We think we better do something about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by that time, the state police had sent a car out, and they would guard the front entrance to make sure that nobody should get in here that wasn't supposed to be in here. Because when word spreads about something like this, you can have the whole community over here.
Sure.
And so I walks out to the front gate, and I asked the cop, and I says, is there anybody around here with an air hammer system that can break up rock? He says, how many do you want?
You're all set.
I says, get a crew out if you can.
Yeah.
Okay. About an hour later, a crew appears with a compressor and the whole darn business, and we manhandled the whole thing down to the entrance of the cave and ran hoses in.
Wow.
And they sat there, and three guys sat there and hammered away on rocks to open up that thing a little bit. Meanwhile, Sloan.
Neil Sloan.
Yeah. Dr. Sloan come down. He got here. And he's a prime caver, world-class type.
I met him in December.
Yeah. Well, he got his training as a medic in Texas.
Ah.
And he was authorized as a medic to do emergency work, like out on the highways and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So he was well acquainted with this sort of thing. And he got his degrees, and he finally got assigned to a hospital. And he said, I learned something. He said, first of all, the hospital is run. Any hospital is run by anesthesiists. He says, I didn't know that.
I wonder why that is.
And so he went back to school and became an anesthesiist. He said the reason was that, he says, anytime I want to go caving, I just announce I'm leaving for a month. Yes, sir.
All right.
And he liked to go to exotic places like France and you know, wherever it was caving.
Yeah.
And he's a prime cave diver.
Wow.
He knows that game too.
Wow.
And he would like to go cave diving and all this stuff. So he came down here. He crawled into the cave. He says, I was 20 feet from the victim, and I knew what the problem was. I had a drunk on my hands.
Oh, boy.
He said, I could smell it.
Wow, 20 feet away.
And the guy was unconscious or something at the bottom of the volcano room.
Had fallen down.
They were up there drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them decided to come out and managed to make it.
Mm-hmm.
He fell off the edge of the volcano room, tumbled down, hit rocks, and broke his back in three places.
Oh, wow.
And was lying at the bottom of the volcano. And just as luck would have it, this other group was in the cave roaming around at that hour.
Wow.
And came across him. Talk about luck.
Yeah, no kidding.
And they came up and they started the whole thing. When our people came down to start the rescue, we had electronics people. They ran a telephone line from the entrance of Buckner's all the way to the volcano room.
Wow, that's a long way.
All the way to the bottom of the volcano.
Yeah.
When Sloan got to his patient, he said, I thought I was pretty sure I had a back problem.
Mm.
He was able to get on a telephone and talk to Methodist Hospital direct.
Amazing.
And we had run a phone line all the way to the entrance that converted to a transmitter that went to a repeater at IU, and that repeater put it on the telephone system, and that went to Indianapolis. He sat in that cave 3,000 feet back from an entrance.
Yeah.
And ordered a helicopter, the Lifeline helicopter, in from Indianapolis.
Wow.
To come down here to the airport.
Wow.
Meanwhile, we called on the local hospital, and they sent out two ambulances that sat here all day long waiting for him to get out. And the Red Cross came out and served up food and stuff. And, well, morning comes. Pretty soon, somebody went to these two guys that was sleep, opened the car up. They were
hungover.
hungover. And he said, "Don't you know that a man of yours is injured in that cave?" "Oh, he'll be all right." And they went back to sleep.
Oh, my goodness.
Finally, they woke up. Here's 100 and some people standing around here. Cavers and rescuers and ambulances and all the rest of it. And they got the story of what was going on. And they decided, well, he wasn't going to need the car. So they pulled into the car and pulled out. And we, to this day, don't know who they were.
Really?
Nice friends to have.
Yeah,
huh?
No kidding.
They never stopped to wait for him to get out or anything. They just left.
Oh, my goodness.
It was late afternoon when we finally got him out of the cave.
Mm.
It was a long haul.
Yeah.
Difficult. Down that crawlway and all.
Yeah.
Finally got him out, brought him up here, and they put him in ambulance and hauled him off to the airport, and they took him directly to Methodist up there. And when it was all over with, everybody was standing around talking about all this. Suddenly somebody come up to me, said, "Aren't you worried about getting sued for this?" Gosh, I never thought about it. And I said, "I don't know." Dr. Sloan was standing there, dirty clothes. You know, he looked like a caver.
Sure.
And Sloan spoke up and he says, "I was called on the telephone about 5 o'clock this morning. Out of my girlfriend's bed to go on a cave call, to go into a dirty old wet mucky cave to rescue some drunk." He says, "I make $100 an hour for what I do at Methodist Hospital."
Yeah.
He says, "Most physicians won't go next door on a call anymore, leave alone drive 50 miles out of his girlfriend's bedroom to go on a cave rescue." And he made it sound like, gosh, this was a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Actually, he enjoyed it.
Well, yeah, of course.
But I know he was a prime caver.
But this was an ordeal. And so, you know, yeah, even if he enjoyed
and it. And so he says, "If I ever charge this guy for services, he'll never pay it." And the guys that were on the air hammer had come up, and they were standing there, and they said, "Do you know what it costs on a Sunday morning to have," and they underlined the word, "to have a union air hammer crew come out and pound away for hours in a cave?" "If we ever charge him, he'll never pay the bill."
He had a lot of people to thank for getting him out of there.
Yeah. And the ambulance people that were standing here said, "Do you know what it costs to have an ambulance stand by for all day?"
Yeah. Much less air.
Yeah.
Air support.
So the next day I took the whole program into my insurance that I had covering, and he took on a look at it and he said, "Don't worry about it." And I have never heard one word from them.
Mm.
They just, I think my insurance agent called the guy's insurance agent and read them the riot act.
Yeah.
And he is a paraplegic in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And he was a 30-year-old man with petrol at home.
Mm.
What the hell is he doing? People can be so stupid, it is absolutely understandable. That was the only big rescue we ever had in Buckner.
Yeah.
A lot of little ones.
1983? Is that when it was? 1983?
When did that happen? Oh, boy, I don't know.
I had heard early 80s.
You might be able to find a record. I forget this one we did that. I probably have it on here someplace. A lot of times you get funny rescues. We got a call all of a sudden. Somebody says, somebody's stuck in the volcano room. How can you get stuck in the volcano room?
It's enormous.
Well, he was a 240-pound man.
Okay.
They had done the circle route, and when you get underneath the volcano room, there's a big pile of dirt coming down out of the volcano.
Yeah.
And then there's water. And if you don't do the volcano, you'll have to go through the water on your belly.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side is the river. It was beside you there, small stream.
Mm-hmm.
They had gotten into that far, and he decided to go up into the volcano. He got up onto the big pile of dirt and pushed his shoulders through the hole going up the volcano and decided his ass wouldn't make it. So he tried to back out and his shoulders wouldn't make it.
Oh, no.
And there he sat.
Oh, no.
On this pile of dirt, unable to go either way. So they brought up, they called a rescue. Somebody come racing out. We got to have a rescue. Described what was going on. So we took some shovels in. And we dug the dirt out from under him, and he fell out, and everything was fine.
Okay, yeah.
So we made a rule. If you weigh over 240 pounds, you shouldn't go into Buckner's circle route.
When was the last time you were in the cave?
I don't know. It's been about 10 years since I've done a circle route.
Yeah.
After... About 10 years ago, 8 years ago or so, my knees decided they'd had enough of this nonsense. And I can't bear down on them strongly anymore. And so I haven't been down to Buckner. I go down into the entrance room and we have a Halloween party or something down
nice.
There. But to do the crawlway no more.
Yeah.
And but if I get into a commercial cave, fine, I'll go caving. But so I haven't been down through the whole system for quite a while now. But that's because I'm getting older.
Do you miss it a lot?
Oh, yeah. I spent a good part of my life down there.
Yeah. So Buckner was resurveyed a few years ago. And Sean Lewis drew the new map. Do you like the new map?
The present map?
Yeah.
Was just done.
Yeah, a few years ago.
I don't know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
2012.
I don't know if there's a date on it or not.
2012.
Okay.
Yeah.
Suddenly some of our people said, we ought to map that thing again. So they did.
Yeah.
But they were using modern equipment. You know, lasers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it turned out that they, really there was no corrections to be made much.
No.
They added a little mileage of stuff and made some minor corrections here and there, but they did draw a nice map.
It's a great map. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was good. But... Buckner Cave.
I came down for the mock rescue that Don Paquette and Anmar Mirza and all them did a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite memories from that weekend is seeing you standing by the map at the shelter and just looking at it.
Yeah.
And me and Charlie Vetters from the CIG got to talking later and we thought, what is he thinking? looking at that map. What is he think? What is Dick Blends thinking as he looks at that
map?
Yeah,
because I'm familiar with every piece of it.
Yeah.
You know, I've been there.
Yeah.
It's neat. I started Indiana University on March the 1st, 1966. I worked for them for 40 years to the day, to the hour, because in 2006, on February the 28th, which was the day before March the 1st,
yeah,
I resigned. I retired. And I was there 40 years to the minute. If I had come to work the next day, I would have started my 41st year. And I was the chief of the electronics shop, physics department, for most of that time, and had a great time. I've been very, very lucky.
Mm.
I've spent my life doing my hobby, and so it's never been... I would just as soon be at the university on Monday morning as to be at home because there was always something to do, to play with.
Yeah.
So in 2006, I retired. And then in 2008, I decided I was getting older and I would like this place to remain caving.
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave it stock, lock, and barrel to the National Speleological Society. They own this house. They own this property.
Wow.
Outright.
Wow.
I have a life estate agreement to stay here for the rest of my life. And, otherwise they own it. So we began to build, we replaced the barn. We built a facility back there. And, finally, when the NSS took over, we had to put some restrictions on. And so the gates and you register to come in here. And so we began to restrict who was coming in. Meanwhile, we thought just before the NSS was to take over the cave, we thought we ought to clean the place.
Mm-hmm.
I met a group in California at a convention, a grotto of some sort, whose hobby was to going around cleaning caves. And they had a big industrial air compressor system on a tractor trailer.
Sandblaster, right?
Sandblasting.
Yeah.
And we demonstrated that thing on a big rock outside of town. We cleaned all the paint off of it and everything. And I thought, this is neat. So I asked him, how would I get this thing to Bloomington? Albuquerque is not in Bloomington.
No.
and the equipment, they were from Albuquerque. And they said, tell us when you want it. We'll bring it out.
Mm.
So we worked up the idea of it and finally told them a time and date. They brought that whole rig out here and left it for 2 years.
Mm.
And we cleaned Buckner Cave from end to end, and we're still doing it.
Yeah.
The equipment went back, finally. They had miles of hose. They could run 3 sandblasters simultaneously at the end of that system.
Wow.
And we cleaned Buckner Cave from all entrances, and we took 6 layers of paint off the signature room.
Oh, wow.
down to the rock. And the cave looks much different than it used to, but it's back to the way it ought to be.
Yeah.
Of course, now we watch that people don't do that, you know. Well, now it's people registering and so on. And they've been told what they can do and what they cannot do. And anybody coming in has to sign one of these things.
Yeah. And, the release and waiver of liability agreement.
Yeah. So we're still doing it.
Yeah.
Our visitation level now is down to about 1,500 a year. For some reason, cavers feel comfortable.
Yeah.
In a cave.
I certainly
some do. Some people are terrified, you know, of the cave. I've had people, I'm claustrophobic. That's the last thing that a caver is, claustrophobic. In fact, I've been in things so darn tight, you wonder if you're going to get out of here or not. But, there is a group of people like that. Of course, there's a group of people that like to jump out of airplanes. you know, and
takes
and
all
like
kinds.
To rappel and so on and so forth.
Sure.
And I'm of a group that likes to go caving. I do not enjoy vertical work.
No.
It's a lot of unnecessary work. In fact, Dick Powell is of that too. He says, I vertical work, if it doesn't lead to a cave, to heck with it. But vertical work is important because of the pits and things that we have in Mexico and so on.
Sure. I got one last question for you. And it's a question that I like to ask everybody who I get to talk to. And everybody kind of answers it, gives me similar answers, but everybody's got their own kind of spin on it. And that is simply, why do you think you like to do it? Why did you like to cave? Why do you like caves in general?
I think it's something that's built into you. Don't tell my mother, who's long dead, but anyway, we lived in Valparaiso, Indiana, back in 1930. We lived in a huge house, a mansion. Mm. It was a 16-room house.
Wow.
Four people living in a 16-room mansion. Dad tried to buy it in 1929, and we moved into it. It had a huge area underneath the front porch. It had huge areas otherwise. There was a little entry, and I used to climb in there and get under the front porch and look at things and look out through. And don't ever tell my mother. She would have had a conniption cat fit of the first order. But I enjoyed being in a place like that. I don't know why. I think it's just something that's somehow built into you. There's some people who enjoy doing certain things, you know. I was kind of born that way, I guess. I don't know.
Mm.
Because there are people who wouldn't get caught dead in a cave.
No.
Oh, down in a cave, no. The devil down there. So I don't know. We are, the fact that there are only 10,000 members in the national organization, and that number hasn't really grown over the years since World War II. Our population has almost doubled, but our population in the NSS hasn't doubled.
Hmm.
We are a unique sort of people for some reason. I don't know why. You are one of them. Why do you like a cave? I don't know. You go into a cave and you suddenly feel very comfortable. You know, there aren't very many people who would want to spend 3 weeks in a cave.
I don't know if I'm one of them.
No. Wow. We had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
You have to have that peculiar mental characteristic, I guess. I don't know what it is.
Hmm.
My attraction to electricity is a peculiar mental capability. Very fortunately, I followed it, and it's been a success of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But some people get into doing other things, you know, and they become experts at it, and they enjoy it, and so on. Some people enjoy digging holes, you know, and they go out and they dig holes for buildings and and all that. They like to run bulldozers, and there's other people that like to jump out of bridges and jump off of cliffs and do all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And there are people who like to just sit in their room and play on a computer all day.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just something that somehow is built into your makeup, because it doesn't involve a lot of people.
Yeah. Good answer. I like it.
There might be 30,000 people in the country who are really interested in caves. 30 or 40,000. What's that?
Yeah.
A small percentage of the total.
Yeah, very.
Caving is a cheap way of having a lot of fun.
It sure is. It sure is.
And it's great as long as you don't mind getting dirty.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so, absolutely right.
Yeah. And
well, I'd like to just say that I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you.
Well, it's fun, and I like a record made of what been going on around here, you know.
Sure.
I just happened to be a part of it, a small part of it. You're a part of it. Sam Frischauer, you ought to get a hold of him.
I'd love to.
He's got a wild background. He went down and bought Blue Springs Caverns, right?
Yeah, sure did.
he was part owner of the darn thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, I bought Buckner Cave. But...
Two very different paths.
And Sam has a very remarkable background. And he was one of the Sullivan heirs.
Yeah.
And it's too bad you can't interview people like Bob Armstrong and so on anymore.
I know. I was fortunate enough to talk to him at Cave Capers a number of years ago, just before he passed away, but he was a good guy.
No, he, character. He's a real character, believe me.
Well, thank you, Dick. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for coming out.
Oh, we went for 2.5 hours.
Yeah, I guess we did.
This is great.
And it was. Thanks again, Dick. And you hear that, Sam? I'm coming for you. I'd love to have you on. Sam Frischauer also wrote a book that I have 2 copies of. I bought one, and my mother-in-law bought me one because she didn't know I already had it. A Guide to Caves and Karst of Indiana. An interesting read for any caver. And right toward the end there, when he was talking about Bob Armstrong, when I was there, I could really tell that he missed his friend. Like I said, I wish I could have talked to him more when I saw him at grotto meetings just before he passed. Bob Armstrong led Lost River field trips in southern Indiana all the way up to just a few months before he died. Prolific caver. Good man. Well, that's it for this month's Caving Podcast. Again, thanks to all the listeners. Again, if you're new to caving, find your grotto and join it. You can find it at the NSS website, caves.org. Register for My Grotto's event, Indiana Cave Capers, the first weekend in August at My Grotto's website, cigcaves.com. Support the show by supporting our sponsor, Swago, at swagogear.com. Am I forgetting anything? I don't think so. I'm Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next month, kill nothing but time.